Pretty cool.
My name is Mary Owen Streeter. I am 64 years old. Today is August 6, 2012, and we're in Detroit, Michigan. I'm here with my father and my brother, both named Ray Owen, and we are here to interview my father today.
And how coincidental is that? Then I'm also Ray Owen, and Ray Henderson Owen, 66 years old. Oh, geez. It's August 6, 2012, but we knew that already. And I am the number one son of my dad and my mother, the Ismeister, Isabel Mahoney Owen.
And I'm Ray Owen, Sr. I am the father of these two and one other daughter. I am 90 years old. The date today is August 5th of 2012, and we are in Detroit, Michigan.
Okay, that's good. As a matter of fact, it's August 6th. Isn't that also a, that's an historic date too, isn't it, Dad? August 6th. Wasn't that an historic date?
I don't know.
Was that,
Oh, no, August 6th, when I first enlisted?
Yeah.
That was August 3rd.
Oh, August 3rd, okay. Just a few days off, but how many years ago?
1942.
Oh, geez. Anyhow, we're here at in Detroit at the Story Tellers.
70 years ago.
And recording this this little conversation with Mary and myself and Dad. And anytime you want to say anything, you just jump right on in.
Oh, you're the talker of the family.
Okay, there you go. And what we're doing is we're dedicating this to... Ooh. You can't see it. So we're going to dedicate this to Mom. How's that? All right, let's get over this stuff. And, of course, this is a little recorded memory for the kids, the grandkids. Great-grandkids? Actually, there's a couple of those, too, aren't there, Dad?
There are six of them. Yeah.
Oh, jeez. Time's flying. Yeah. I guess we're having fun. Anyhow, we got all kinds of conversations we want to cover here with you, Dad. Talk about things we've heard from you, stories. We want you to verify some of these stories because, you know, we hear from Aunt Virginia sometimes. There's a little bit of a difference in these stories, but we want this recorded correctly, right from you. And we'll send Aunt Virginia a copy of this just so that she can...
No, she can't dispute.
No, she can't.
Oh, she will anyways.
Yeah, I know it. That's for sure. That's Aunt Virginia. Anyhow, you know, a lot of things, a lot of direction here to try and sort out. But I think what thought that I had was that, looking at this book, Detroit, Our Greatest Generation. Generations are defined by generally... decades, 10-year groups or 20-year groups, whatever. Dad's from a generation called our greatest generation, or referenced as such. I'm from a generation. Our kids are from a generation. Somebody were to ask me, my generation, where were you when? What would you say, Mary?
When John Kennedy was assassinated.
1963.
Yep.
That kind of defined our generation. Vietnam was raging, the economy, civil rights, etc. We were in high school, went to college, on and on after that. Today's generation, if you ask them, where were you when, what would they say?
Oh, definitely 9/11.
9/11 defines their generation, when the Twin Towers went down. Dad defines a different generation. And we're going to ask you, where were you when?
When the Japs attacked Pearl Harbor.
December 7.
December 7, 1941.
Okay, let's hear a little bit about that, Dad, because what we're talking about leads into your service career, and this is where it all began. Go ahead.
Well, by the time we heard about it, which was early on Sunday morning, it was late back here in Detroit. Late in the afternoon, I was sitting in a restaurant with a few friends, and they interrupted the radio program, music program, with a flash bulletin. And it said that the Japanese had struck at Pearl Harbor. And I remember a chill went up and down my spine. And I actually didn't even know what Pearl Harbor meant. I had no idea in the world what it meant, where it was, or anything about it. Although it just sounded ominous. That was my first knowledge of the start of the war.
Or at least bringing us into it. It had already been going on in Europe.
Yes.
Sure, Europe.
How old were you then, Ray?
Well, in 1941, I just turned 20.
20 years old, and you're hanging out at the corner, or where were you at?
That was later on.
Oh, okay.
Several months went by, and of course the war was going on, and we went about our business. Most were young people, and it was in August of 42, but hanging around on a street corner in front of the local drugstore, Woodward's Drugstore, Doc Woodward's Drugstore. And a few of us were discussing things about the war and things, and one fellow came along and said that he had been down to see about joining the Naval Air Corps, but he got turned down because of high blood pressure. And that was the first time I even knew there was a Naval Air Corps as such. So that happened. That was probably a Monday or Tuesday morning. And Thursday, I had a dental appointment. And after that, I went on down to the downtown Detroit to the federal building and went upstairs and found the office and walked in. And I saw a group of people working on some paperwork and a chief, as I know him now, sitting at the front room and wouldn't know what I wanted. I just told him I was interested in checking out the Naval Air Corps. So he said, just sit over there and fill out these papers, which it was an aptitude test. So,
which you passed with flying colors.
I aced it, yeah. The aptitude test was just a simple thing
that.
For me, because I was in an apprenticeship program. And
electrical workers.
Math was my forte anyhow, so I liked it. And they finished the paperwork, I collected them, and told us to wait a little bit for results. And then he came back, called off a list of names of people that can go in the back room and have an interview. And after a bit, I was called in, went back there and met a officer in the Navy who had all kinds of ribbons. And so I thought this guy must own the Navy, he had so many ribbons. And we discussed flying, and I told him I'd been building model aircraft. And I was always interested in it. And the truth of the matter was, I hardly made one that ever flew. I got bored when they got to that point and started a new one. And I knew nothing about flying. But I gave him a nice soft shoe shuffle. And so they said, wait in the other room. So we waited. And then after it was all over, they listed all the names of, well, these guys come back tomorrow morning for a physical. So next day I was down there for the physical. And it took a while to get through it all, but finally I passed that. And then they said, come back tomorrow morning, which you know is Saturday, for an eye exam. Went back for the eye exam and went through all that. It was quite a rigorous exam, and I remember certain incidents in it, but the long and short of it was that I passed it. And they said, come back Monday morning, report in this room. So I come back Monday morning, and they said, right, raise your right hand and repeat after me. And I repeated after them, and they said, now you are in the Navy.
Wow, that was that quick of a process.
So from the time I even heard about the thing, it was less than a week by the time I was involved.
What made you...
Go ahead.
What made you decide to join the service?
Well, it was just the curiosity of the fact that this one fellow got turned down. He was a nice, big guy, healthy-looking guy, strong, and he got turned down for high blood pressure on applying for the Naval Air Corps. And I was just curious, so I thought I'd go down and see what it was about. And it was like a process of osmosis. I just kind of went from point A to point B to point C to point D. And point D was says, raise your right hand, and there I am. And I was in the Naval Air Corps.
Oh, boy.
I was enlisted in it. And the other thing, of course, was that the draft was, at that time, was nipping at my heels. And I just preferred to select the place I was going rather than be drafted into something I had no idea where or what it would be.
Well, that's good.
And I think, fortunately, I did the right thing.
Absolutely, Lieutenant J.G. Mm-hmm. So as time goes on, you end up in basic training. What was the first plane that you flew?
Actually, the first plane I ever flew was a Piper Cub.
Oh, jeez. Training for the Navy in a Piper Club? Club?
In December, I was sent down to Asheville, or Hendersonville, actually, North Carolina, just outside of Asheville. It was called the Asheville-Hendersonville Airport. It was a small private airport, and they had three or four Piper Cubs assigned to them. They had civilian people in charge of the operation, civilian pilots, and they taught us how to fly. I remember my first flight, I got in the front seat of this little Piper Cub, and the instructor got in the back. I had a gentleman who was, at that time, I thought he was pretty old. He was probably about 32. I thought he was the old man of the air group. And we took off, and we're flying around a little bit. It felt kind of nice, and then I look out the window, and it's a new experience for me. And he says, well, now you try it. So I put my feet on the pedals, and I put my hand on the stick, and I didn't hardly breathe. I wouldn't touch this. I wouldn't move anything. I figured, this plane runs into a mountain. It's his fault because I'm not moving it. It's doing well. Leave it to him. But finally he said, well, let's try a turn. Little left stick, little left rudder. And I kind of got a feel of turning left and right and doing a lot of things. So that was my first flight. And I got a little more comfortable after a bit knowing it. That thing stays in the air. It does pretty good.
So after that, one of the planes that you trained in, was that the Stearman?
Well, that was a little bit
or
later.
What was the biplane?
That was Stearman, yeah.
Okay.
Imagine that.
Our dad actually flew a biplane.
Wow.
Well, yeah, it was the first.
Boy, oh, boy.
But that was a little bit later. We spent probably 2.5 months down there in this Piper Cub area. So learned to solo. Learned my instrument flight. Needle ball airspeed, they call it. You just had basic instruments, and you learn to control them. You learn to control the plane by using them properly. And after that, I was sent down to Athens, Georgia, for ground school. It was all at ground school. I was down there 3 months, and all we did was ground school. We did training. We learned theories of flight, aerology, math was involved, of course, and code. We learned Morse code.
Dots and dashes. But
there were no flying, no nothing down there. And from there, I went to Olathe, Kansas. And that was a big, big airfield with nothing but biplanes. You don't want to talk about biplanes. First plane out there was a Navy trainer, an N2S, I think they called it. It was just a biplane with wired struts. And sometimes when you land them hard, new cadets, if you land them kind of hard, the wings would flop. They were built, they were resilient.
And then you
graduate from that into the Stearman.
Okay.
Which is a little firmer plane, a little stronger plane. And
so eventually, and through this process, you end up being selected to fly a Navy fighter plane.
Oh, yeah. We went through that. From that, I went to Corpus Christi, and the SNVs and the SNJs, which are... Each one's a little more advanced than the previous one. SNV was we called the Vaulty Vibrator. It had fixed landing gear, and it had a cranked, I think it had cranked flaps. And then we went to SNJ, which had retractable landing gear and automatic flaps, so hydraulic flaps.
All right, so now you're going from these big land-based airstrips to ultimately having to land that plane on that postage stamp bouncing around
on
the
water.
Oh, yeah,
but you're jumping way ahead of the picture.
Yes, we are.
It takes a long time to do all this.
Absolutely.
Went through the SNJ, which is known as the Army had an AT-6 Texan. That was their designation for the same plane. And from there, I went to Opa-locka, Florida, and got into SBDs, which is a dive bomber, but I took a fighter training syllabus, learning fighter tactics with a dive bomber. So we did some dive bombing, and we did some aerial gunnery and air-to-ground gunnery, stuff like
so
that.
So that's where you picked up your ability to drop your bombs, shoot your missiles, fire your...
Well, we didn't have missiles.
I thought you had or rockets.
We had rockets later on, not at that point, though.
Yeah.
Then I went from there up to Great Lakes, checked out on the carrier landings, because we'd had a lot of carrier landing practice on the on the ground, on the ground, on the landing strips.
Sure.
The field carrier landing practice, they called it.
Yeah.
And then we went up to Great Lakes, and we actually did some touch and goes on a converted ship.
That was right outside of Chicago, wasn't it?
Yeah, outside, north of Chicago, yeah. It's out in Lake Michigan.
Yeah.
And I qualified there, sent back over to Philadelphia Naval Station, and was assigned to the VF-81 at Cape Cod. And when I went up to Cape Cod, that's where I got into the F-6s.
And that was Air Force, or Otis Air Force Base?
Otis Air Force Base, yeah, on
Cape Cod, Massachusetts.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to digress just a moment and interject a little story out of that experience. Right?
Right.
We know the story. Here it comes. Anyhow, here we have, three of you guys?
Well, yeah, we got a training program. And, well, no, Charlie and I were ensigns, and we had, there was another, Kaz was a lieutenant. The three of us, we rented a house in Monument Beach, off base.
Right.
And that's where we lived, except when we had
three good-looking guys hanging out in the neighborhood, and a young man being impressed and hanging around with you guys. What was his name?
Raymond Jones.
Raymond Jones.
Young, he was about 14 or 15.
Sure, sure. But he knew all the people in the neighborhood, didn't he? Especially some of the young ladies.
Yeah, he knew a few young ladies.
He knew the right young lady, didn't he?
Well, actually, he knew a gal down the street, Patty Blunt.
Uh-oh.
And that was your mother's girlfriend. And your mother used to come down and visit with her sometimes down on the Cape. Or came over because they had a place on the Cape. And they ran into Raymond one day, asked him, would you like to meet some Navy aviators? Oh, yes. So he arranged to bring him over to the house and meet us. Of course, we all got dressed up, cleaned up, and everything looked presentable. And the day that they were coming over, Patty's uncle, who was a Monsignor, was coming down, so the whole family was going to be there to meet the Monsignor. So she couldn't get away, so your mother came with Raymond. And that's where we met.
So Bob came over by herself with this
young Raymond.
Kid,
he was
introducing.
He was the chaperone.
I didn't know these little twists of the story here.
Well, I know. I understood later that before they came over, Raymond said, "Now, when I say it's time to go, we're going to leave." So anyhow, the outcome was she came in. I was upstairs when she arrived, so she met Kaz and Charlie, and then I came downstairs, and of course, she said it was love at first sight.
So this is the grand entrance,
this is
Dad.
The grand entrance.
In your uniform.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, and here we have Isabel Mahoney. Okay.
All,
I like this.
All dialed up to the nines. You know.
The daughter of the infamous Dr. Walter F. Mahoney. So this is one of his four daughters. You better be careful, buddy.
So, yeah, that's where we met. And we sat around. We talked for a while. I had a couple of, drinks, or I don't know if we had some hors d'oeuvres or what. But finally we decided we'd go over to a local pub for dinner, actually. Get some dinner and dancing. So
it was the first of...
And Raymond says, well, come on, Isabel, it's time for us to leave. And my roommate, Kaz, says, come on, Raymond, we'll take you home. Kaz had an old Chevy Roadster with a rumble seat.
Oh, jeez.
So they took him home, and I went home with Isabel.
Yeah.
And went to her home, met her mother, and she told her mother where we were going, which was Novak's Tavern, I think it was.
Novak's Terrace.
Terrace, yeah. Over in Buzzards Bay.
Oh, jeez.
Went over there and had something to eat and a few drinks and did some dancing until the wee hours. We had a good time. We started dating a lot. When we had time, when I had days off, we'd meet. She picked me up. We'd go to Coonamessett Inn, which was a big inn down below there, and a nice fireplace arrangement. And we sit there and have something to eat and drink and listen to music. And it was one of the things that came in was, I'll be seeing you. That kind of became our song.
There we go. So then eventually you get deployed from Otis, yeah, and you end up out in the Pacific?
Well, I got sent from there. Actually, I went up to Boston and met a friend of mine from back home. And we visited for a day. I was waiting for Charlie because I left the base, but the rest of the guys hadn't checked out on night carrier landing practice yet. And I was flying in on the skipper's wing. I was in the first group, so we went out one night, and we all qualified. And then they closed down the field because the weather was getting bad, rainy and everything. So I was free to go the next day, so I went up to meet this friend of mine, Norm Trudel. And Charlie was a good friend of mine. I waited up there for a couple of days till he joined us, and then we went on up to Schenectady, which was his home, met his family, and stayed with them for a couple of nights and met his girlfriend and all that stuff. And from there, we headed out towards San Diego. So we got to Chicago, stayed a couple of nights there, because we'd run out of money. But Charlie had some money in his suitcase, so he got to pull the luggage out, and he got into the suitcase and pulled out some money. So we had a little money to go on. Got to Los Angeles, spent a night or two there, and wandered around the big city. I don't know what ever happened to Cosby. He didn't join. He wasn't with us during that period, but he joined us later somehow. He went his own way, I guess. And then we went to San Diego. I don't know how long we were down there, a couple of weeks maybe. And finally they got us aboard a ship and sent us out to Pearl Harbor.
So now you're seeing what started this whole episode.
Oh, yeah, we got out to Pearl Harbor, and you can see some of the results. Because we went to, I think, Ford Island. Where were they?
Okay.
Ship docked. Anyhow, we went up there and got aboard a small carrier eventually. I think we went in Pearl Harbor more than a couple of days, 3 days, and they sent us down. Our group was sent down to Maui, which is an island further down this line. We were down there about 3 months for a training program. Did some training and stuff there, some radar directed.
So this is while the war is raging, nonetheless.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Are you starting to chomp at the bit to get out? And
no, every day was busy. Just keeping busy.
But you knew it was coming.
Oh, yeah. We knew we were going to go out. And finally they sent us back to Pearl Harbor. Spent a day or two there and got aboard a transport carrier and took us out to Guam.
Okay.
Offloaded us, and about 3 days later, the USS Wasp came into port, and they got us aboard the ship before they let the air group on the ship leave, because it was scheduled to go out the next day, and they weren't going to go out without an air group. If we don't show up, that air group's going to go back out.
Oh, geez.
So we got aboard. They were happy to see us, and they left. And then we went out for about a three-month tour.
So on that 3 month tour, first time out on a Wasp, you've got is that the Hellcat now?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
The F-6F?
F-6F Hellcat.
Okay.
Yes.
What you recall your first experience in that Hellcat off the Wasp?
Well, we went out with what they call a group grope. We just went out there, and all the planes in the squadron were launched, and we just flew around in a big parade. Following signals and following orders and flying in formation and stuff. Just get a feel of the plane and landing back on the carrier.
Sure, sure. So how was the carrier landing? Ever have a scary moment?
Well, I'm sure we had a lot of you never think of that. You're busy doing your thing. You don't think about being scared. Maybe you think about it later on, you relax and think how close it was. But I was very comfortable in that plane, so I really didn't have too many problems. I didn't have the problems some of the guys had.
Okay. Well, we've got in our possession a black and white photo of some wingtip damage on one of those Hellcats. Where were you?
What happened there? I was in the Philippines. I don't know. I always thought it was island of Leyte. There was a cove on the west side, and there was a Japanese cruiser, light cruiser, I think, anchored in there. And we came upon it. We were on a strike mission through the in the Philippines to raid some airfields. And we came across this carrier, this cruiser sitting at anchor, so we decided to attack it with, as I remember, 13 fighters in our air group. And I was flying wing on the skipper. I was the second plane of formation. So we attacked it with machine guns. I think most of it was fired. If we had rockets or bombs, which we carried either a bomb or six rockets, we'd either fire them off at one of the airfields when we attacked or something, because I don't remember I had any external weapons when we attacked. All I had was a machine gun. And pulling out of the dive, my plane got hit pretty drastically. Had a big hole in the wing that you could almost drop an armchair through.
Oh, boy.
Except it was twisted girders and stuff in there, but the skin was all gone. So when we pulled out, I called the skipper and told him that I had been hit. And he said, "Well, just wait up here. We're going to make another attack, then you join us." So I sat up there about 10 or 12,000 feet watching over my shoulder while they made another machine gun attack on this cruiser, which amounted not much or anything. And then they took off across the island towards the Pacific, and I chased them for about 15 or 20 minutes. We finally caught up to them. I had to fly with full right rudder and full right stick just to keep the wings level.
Keep them level,
And a big drag on that wing. And I finally slid back into position, and we headed back for the fleet. And I kept thinking, now what do I do? I go take this plane up and drop the wheels and stall it a couple times to see how it reacts, or what? We got into our landing altitude, and echeloned off to the right, dropped tail hooks, signaled each other tail hooks down, dropped our wheels. Skipper went in for a landing. I went in right behind him, landed the plane, and they taxied me over to the outboard elevator, took me down the hangar deck, pulled the plane in there, and they took the wing off, photographed it, threw it over the side. Well, of course, they stripped it. They took the aileron was never touched, so they saved the salvage the aileron. Of course, you have machine guns in the wing and the ammunition boxes. All that stuff, I'm sure, is salvaged. Throw the wing away, put another wing on the plane.
You drop it off the fantail, and that's the end of it?
No, I throw it off the side.
Yeah? Okay. Yeah. Reattach a new wing?
Put on a new wing, and that plane was probably back in the air that afternoon and the next day.
Jeez.
That's all I was wrong with. It was just a bad wing tip.
Wow. Well, you flew in a group. What was the name of your immediate group on the carrier?
Oh,
you had a dozen guys in a, what do you call it?
Well, there was, I don't know, probably around 80 pilots. I'm not sure just how many we had in our
group. But when you went out, together, you didn't go out 80 in a...
Oh, no, no. Sometimes you got a dozen planes.
Okay.
Eight planes is a normal.
Okay.
So we'd have eight planes maybe up on a CAP and eight planes on a strike.
So you've been, you were up in Tokyo Bay?
Yeah, we worked our way up there, all the way up from the Philippines, Formosa, what's the other one?
The Hump?
Yeah. Oh, Iwo Jima, We were up in the Iwo Jima area at the time of the strike.
Yeah, wow. I didn't know that until just recently.
We went to Tokyo, struck at Tokyo one day, then came back. And when we had they were having the attacks on Iwo Jima, another young fellow and myself, we got the duty to go down south of there and pick up a couple new airplanes to bring back to the ship. So they transferred us over to a destroyer, and we took a ride down way south of the island during the attack and transferred the USS Attu. Really? ATTU, Attu. And we got new planes. And then the next day we launched out there and brought them back, circled to the west of Iwo Jima. You could see all the planes in the air and the ships on the water and all that stuff.
So in all of these strikes throughout the Pacific there, out of your air carrier group, a lot of guys were lost.
Yeah, we lost, actually, we were listed 17 members lost in our records, but I came to find out through you that one of the guys we lost was actually captured by the Japanese, was a prisoner of war until after the war ended.
Well, that leads me to where I was going. You're jumping ahead of me. Laura Hildebrand wrote a book called Unbroken. Fascinating. The story I think it was a B-24 pilot, also shot down in the Pacific and floated in his life raft into Japanese hands and spent the several years in Japanese concentration camps, etc. I was reading the book, and at the end of the book, acknowledgments, this author listed all these people, and I'm reading it. I sat up in my bed and I says, oh my God, she interviewed Minos Miller. Minos Miller, what happened to him?
He went down off of Formosa, and they had him in a life raft. And my understanding of the story was they had a rescue submarine on the way to pick him up. And they claimed that the sub was within a mile of him. And just planes that were circling around that had been in his flight had to leave because of low fuel. But the sub never found him. And so he was listed as lost at sea. And had no idea what happened to him. But turns come to find out, and later after reading this about him, an article on the internet, he was picked up by a Japanese trawler, became a prisoner of war, and did come back.
Spent the rest of the war in
a Japanese
prison camp.
Came back down in the South, I'm not sure.
Alabama, Georgia,
somewhere down there. Became a lawyer and finally a judge.
Yep.
And I didn't even know about it until I learned about it being back, I think, a year or two after he passed away.
Yes. It was right around 2005 I ran across him on the internet, and I said, my God, that's the guy that...
So actually, we only lost 16.
Yeah. We thought there was an...
Amongst them was a good friend of mine, Charlie Butler.
Sure. Sure. And we have pictures of him, don't we?
Oh, yeah. I have pictures
with,
of him.
With Mom and Dad and so on.
He was shot down. He was shot down over Japan in...
Boy, oh boy.
So when you read the name, Minos Miller?
Correct.
You recognize the name?
Oh, yeah, because I knew it from my dad's...
Well, I told the story about him, this guy, Minos Miller. He was a full lieutenant.
And my impression was you guys had the honorary burial at sea?
No, there was no honorary burial, but he was recognized in our annual...
That he was...
He was lost.
And from 1944-45 till 2005, thought he was gone.
Well, I did, but I'm sure others.
But
just like Charlie Butler, he was shot down over Japan, and they got him listed as lost at that time. Then in parentheses, got AA question mark. We really don't know what happened to him.
Just gone, and
might have been an aircraft.
Boy, oh boy, well.
But those are the things that happen, and a lot of our losses were operational losses. We had a couple of guys out to sea. We were coming back from a mission or doing something. They were chasing each other around in the clouds and ran into one another.
Oh, gee.
And one of them went down, the other one got back to the ship. So we lost a man there. Operational losses.
Tragedies like that.
We had one, remember this guy, he was our engineering officer. And I was watching landings one day on deck, and his plane came in with a... The engine sounded like a threshing machine. It was just horrible sound. And I told the guy next to me, I said, if I get that plane this afternoon, I'll down it. I won't fly it. The guy that took it out that afternoon went down in it.
Just the mechanical took him down.
It was a mechanical problem.
Oh,
the engine, I don't know why that plane was even flying, but the engine just sounded like it. terrible condition.
I made a poor judgment on that one.
He was flying anti-submarine patrol, which put him at maybe 200 or 300 feet off the water. When the engine quit on him, he didn't have a chance in the world.
Not that low. We're running out of time here, Dad. We want to get to the world-famous story. Where were you when you got that letter?
Oh, we were out in the Pacific somewhere. And I got a card from Isabel.
So during all this time, you were writing to Mom.
Oh, yeah, we write letters back and forth. Mail was a little sporadic. You'd go out. When you got refueled, you'd send it over to a tanker. They'd take it back, and somewhere along the line it got mailed. And when you were in rendezvousing for refueling, the tanker would have your mail with them. And that's when you get your mail now and again. And so when you did get it, you get 4, 5, 6, a dozen letters, depending on who writes
you. So you get this letter from Isabel Mahoney.
Yeah. And, well, I got a card. It was a card. She bought it, and it was like a Valentine's card or something. And it said, "How can I say yes if you don't ask?" So I wrote a letter back and asked.
That's
so that's
great.
How we got engaged.
That's a perfect story. That's why we're sitting here. So out of that whole episode, she says, I can't say yes if you don't ask. And so you asked. And
yeah.
How many years of marriage?
Well, yeah. Well, we had over 65.
Three kids?
Yeah. Three kids, 9 grandchildren, and 6 great-grandchildren to date.
Oh, boy. That's great.
Yeah,
awesome.
It was, I got back in late March of 45. So...
And you got married.
Your mother then? And her mother came out to Detroit to meet my family.
Yeah. And you got married in Westboro, Mass. In 1945.
And
what was the date?
1945. You got married in Westboro?
Westboro, April 21st.
April 21st. There you go.
1945. Yeah,
oh,
well.
Boy.
You jumped in on me, but she, they'd come out to the house for supper, so. Your grandma says, come on, Isabel, let's go back to the hotel. So I took him back down there, and she called home, and she said, the wedding's on.
Perfect. Well, we're wrapping this thing up, so I think we've got just enough time for all our dedications.
Oh, yeah.
Who are we dedicating to? Oh, well, of course, to Mom. And then
Mom.
We got a role to, well, Ray, Mary, and Janet, that's us.
Yeah.
That's right.
And then we've got Raymond Paul. Brian Francis, Andrew, Christine.
Andrew, Michael, David.
And then Janet's kids.
Kevin. Chris, and Jess.
There you go. And then the assorted great-grandkids, but this is for them.
Yeah.
That we're doing this. So this is something they can listen to at some point in the future and remember some things. Wish we had more time. There's so many things that we had written down and thought we would talk about.
I'm amazed.
But some great stories here, stories that they've never heard. And some little story tidbits here I've never heard.
I don't know what they are.
I like those. That's for sure. Yeah. Well, maybe we'll have to think about doing another one of these and roll into the local 58 and then the St. Monica's, Dad's Club. And Mary has just recently put together all those old 8mm
yes, I got a lot of them on a
movies.
DVD.
We were watching them last night. Cheryl and I were watching some of those from... way back when, the St. Monica picnics. Boy, you look slick out there on second base, Dad, when you hit that deep fly out over Art Dean's head. That was a ton of fun. So
yeah, we had good. Well, it was a good neighborhood.
Oh, it sure was.
We knew everybody within a 4-block area. You know?
Yep.
Everybody participated in everything.
That's about it. It was back in the day when you lived in a neighborhood, and that's what you knew.
Oh yeah.
Yep. Things have changed, that's for sure. But it still goes back to family.
Oh, yeah. Family is important.
And why do you feel it's important for your family to know these stories?
Probably to get a sense of their own roots.
Or who you are, or who we are.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Have you got my little sheet over there, Virginia? who has helped narrate this for us, prompted us a couple of times. We appreciate her input. But I've got a paragraph at the bottom you can read for me. Why is it important for us to be doing this? Read that for me, would you?
Why didn't you read it? Because I'm not mic'd.
Oh, well, I heard you over there. We encourage you to use this space to describe your identity. So this is my own identity. But this goes to the question that Virginia just asked off mic somewhat. Why is it important for us to do this? Is that what how you worded it? Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Mary. Read that for me. Oh, you can't. It says, describe your identity. I'm a proud son. How's that? Brought up in a close and loving family with moral and ethic. So let Dad read it. He can read this stuff. I got it now. All right, with moral and ethical direction, these traits still reflect in me in my everyday life. That's why we do this. We're hoping our kids feel that sense.
Hey, you want to try that again without all
yeah,
that?
Yeah, I can't. Just too much in there.
Sentimental family.
But that's why we want our kids to hear this stuff. Because they have that same root, and they come from that point. We're just trying to identify it in words for them. And their day will come when they're going to have to, you know, sit down and dialogue out for their kids and grandkids. So this has been fun. We had a great time with this. And we're definitely going to tell other people about this, and we're going to dupe this CD out, and a lot of people are going to get it in the family.
Thank you
so
both.
So we
want to
thank you for this. Dad,
thank you.
Yeah, we love you, Dad.
Thank you, and I love you guys, too.
Perfect.
I don't know if Virginia knows it or not, but this book on the Detroit, our greatest generation, has my picture on it right in the front cover.
Yep, right there. I don't know if you're familiar with this program, but, yeah.
That was a program they did here in Detroit
about two years ago. Anyhow, that sounds good.
You know, Sonny,
we can go on and on and on.
Anything else?
I think we pretty much got it. We choked our way through the very end of this thing.
I'm glad.